noted author and history professor Dr. Paul Meyer on the uniqueness of Issues Etc.
I'm delighted not only to listen to Issues Etc., but also to have the privilege of being on the program from time to time. Issues is never afraid to take a stand on the thorny, vexing issues that clutter our daily horizons. And it does so in the name of a solidly based Christianity that doesn't flirt with fads or fantasies, whereas some Christian programs sidestep ethical and doctrinal questions in our day. Issues takes them head-on in a fearless, responsible, thoughtful manner. Both head and heart are involved when Issues applies Holy Scripture.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift today. Donate online at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
The uniqueness of this site is that we have the water source of the ancient city of Jerusalem here, and around the water source, in order to protect it, massive fortifications were built already 3,800 years ago in the time of the Canaanites, and later on reused during the time of the Judean monarchy in order to protect the water source in times of war and siege.
That's Haifa University's Professor Ronnie Reich, who has, for the last 15 years, been in charge of an archaeological dig that has uncovered a Canaanite fortress, and you heard him say it, almost 4,000 years old, and having some nexus with the biblical narrative in the Old Testament, in particular, I think it's King David he's talking about. Joining us to talk about this reported discovery of a Canaanite fortress in Old Jerusalem, Dr. Paul Meyer, Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University, author of several books, including his latest, The Constantine Codex. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Todd.
This thing has been there in Old Jerusalem. I mean, that's a very highly excavated area of the world. It's been there for almost 4,000 years. Why does it take so long to find these things?
Well, actually, that particular site has been discovered about 100 years ago already. It is indeed the water source for Jerusalem. It's called either the Spring Gihon, G-I-H-O-N, or the Virgin Spring. This is the source of water for ancient Jerusalem. The city of David is the most ancient section of Jerusalem. Indeed, that was David's stronghold. He conquered it, you recall, by having his commandos go up through a shaft from that tunnel leading to that spring, and they conquered it from the Jebusites. So this is just absolutely drenched with biblical history. Now, certainly he didn't dig the tunnel. Later on, Hezekiah did, but he didn't dig the shaft either. This was there from the start. And this, by the way, is where James Michener got his idea for his novel, The Source. Remember, Makor was out. It didn't have any interior water supply, but there was a spring nearby, and so they concealed the source of that spring and then had an underground a tunnel that went under the walls to serve the city in case of siege. Well, this is exactly what has happened to Jerusalem for the last 4,000 years. Now, first, the Canaanites were in charge, and especially a special tribe of them called the Jebusites, and so this is the fortress that they have now uncovered. What makes the archaeology so difficult there and why it took 15 years is because there are various occupations at various strata, and they had to keep it very carefully clear as to who was building what and where. And that's the reason why I wasn't really surprised when they made this announcement, but because this spring has been known from ancient times all the way down to Hezekiah, who was a wonderful king, remember, contemporary of Isaiah. He got 15 more years of his life and so forth. This Hezekiah built a renewed tunnel to connect that spring with the Pool of Siloam. And this is a tunnel that's still visible today. So it's just absolutely drenched with biblical history.
What take us in a kind of our mind's eye to a dig like this? Are they going deep underground? Well, we're talking about walls that originally they're estimating were 23 feet thick, built with stones that were about 10 feet wide. What would we have been looking at the original structure?
Well, we're talking about a very, very strong defensive wall, because The Canaanites didn't try to hide this fortress. Everybody knew it was there, and everybody knew why it was there. And for that reason, they had to defend it with the same kind of integrity that they used for their own city itself. Later on, they were more sophisticated about it, and indeed, they no longer they kind of concealed it better, and therefore, the enemies, particularly the Assyrians, when they arrived in the Holy Land around 720s B.C., they did conquer the 10 northern tribes, you recall. And then they came further south, wanted to do the same thing to Hezekiah, but besieged him inside of Jerusalem. But Hezekiah could stand the siege because that tunnel that he had built took the water from the same spring we're talking about and kept the city alive, and the Syrians finally gave up and returned to Assyria. So it's just interesting, and they didn't bother concealing it in the previous years. Therefore, they built a huge fortress around it, and they didn't have to do that later on.
So when David shows up to this site that had already been a Jebusite, a Canaanite site for some time, even though I don't think really the Bible indicates his thinking here, can we surmise that he says, look, what better place to establish a headquarters than this remarkable fortress?
Indeed, it doesn't seem as though he built on that particular site, though, because by now maybe it was in some kind of disrepair. You have to remember the topography has changed dramatically through the years, and so has the building sites. As they get built up, they're destroyed, and they're rebuilt, and they're destroyed. This happens repeatedly. As a matter of fact, it happened 13 times in Jesus' day in Jerusalem. Since Jesus' day in the city of Jerusalem, and so he's going to build a little higher up, further in the city. But nevertheless, I'm sure that he realized the importance of that water source and kept it protected. Clearly, right from the start, he would have to do that.
Before we take this break, why has that particular site, not the fortress necessarily, but what came to be known as David's City, or this outcropping where Jerusalem, the original city, once stood, why is it so strategically important, aside from its biblical significance?
Well, it lies between the great valley of the Jordan on one side, you might say, the Kidron, of course, going down to the Jordan, and the plain of Sharon further to the west, and it's in the Shapila, that is the high spine of Israel, and therefore it's a good lookout location from Jerusalem. You can look eastward all the way to the Dead Sea Valley very easily, and westward also, so it's a high city, and therefore all ancient fortresses are built on a high level, and it commands the whole countryside.
Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. We're talking about a reported discovery of a Canaanite fortress in Old Jerusalem. When we come back, we'll kind of go into Old Jerusalem, in particular Solomon's Temple, and talk about what is left archaeologically for us to find there. Stay tuned. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300: Trinity Lutheran, Brooklyn, New York; Hope Lutheran, Birmingham, Alabama; Our Savior Lutheran, Paradise, California; St. John Lutheran, Ray, Michigan; Peace with Christ Lutheran, Fort Collins, Colorado; Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Kimberling City, Missouri; The Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Salinas, California; St. John's Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin; and St. John's Lutheran, Colton, California. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org and click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In Higher Things, we believe that if you put good Christ crucified for you Lutheranism into a youth, you'll get a good Christ crucified for you Lutheran youth. Join us this July at the Higher Things Crucified Youth Conferences in Florida, Wisconsin, Utah. Check us out at www.higherthings.org. Higherthings.org. Dare your youth to be Lutherans this summer.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the reported discovery of a Canaanite fortress in Old Jerusalem on this Tuesday afternoon, April the 8th. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University. Dr. Meyer, before we move on from that tunnel, I understand that there's actually an inscription that now sits in an archaeological museum in Istanbul, Turkey, an inscription to commemorate the digging of Hezekiah's digging of that monumentally long tunnel that was once guarded by this fortress. Tell us about that inscription.
It's one of the oldest examples of a Hebrew inscription, and indeed the famous good King Hezekiah, the one who was one of the reformers, he took the trash out of the temple, you recall, got 15 more years of his life after earnest prayer, and so it goes. Anyway, Hezekiah commissioned a tunnel that would indeed get its water from the spring Gihon and the virgin spring we've been talking about, and then have it go under the walls of Jerusalem and then under a limestone hill and into a pool, a catch basin on the other side. And the tunnel was dug by two teams of workmen starting at opposite ends. And when they joined, they were only 5 feet off after hacking through 1,700 feet of solid limestone. And he was very proud of that. And in this inscription, it goes something like this. The tunnel, and this is the history of the tunnel. As I had two workmen starting it up at sides and so forth, they hacked. And when they heard hammer blows on the other side, they found that they had joined the tunnel and the waters of the Gihon could flow freely into the Pool of Siloam. And by the way, the Pool of Siloam has enormous significance in the New Testament, you recall, because our gospel lesson for a couple Sundays ago, you recall, was about Jesus healing the blind man, telling him to go wash in the Pool of Siloam, and he'd receive his sight. And he did, John chapter 9. So this is the very pool we're talking about. Now, for many decades, pilgrims were shown the pool, and frankly, it was kind of disappointing. It's a pretty small rectangular structure near the tunnel entrance, and water's kind of muddy. Well, the good news is that's only the catch basin, the beginning of the Siloam water system, because about 15 years ago, they discovered the real Pool of Siloam, which is about seven times as large and is a huge pool in and of itself, a little bit further down what they call the Silwan Valley today. That's the Arabic version of Siloam. So it's just fascinating to see how these biblical accounts are not mythology. They're not fairy tales. They're not myth or fantasy or fable. They're real, because here's the background. Here's the geographical location that these things took place. And I really have to laugh at the Old Testament critics who, some of them are so extreme, they will doubt that David ever lived, or Solomon. And the skeptics are rather scathing, and suddenly they're all quiet down by the time you get to Hezekiah. Now, who in his right mind would doubt that there's a Hezekiah? If his name shows up in stone, and here's the tunnel he built, you can walk through it today. It's one of the fascinating sites in the Holy Land, I think, because if you walk through it today, you have it. A part of the Holy Land looking exactly today, the same as it did 2,000 years ago, if Jesus would have walked through it. So, I mean, it's interesting how archaeology comes along and gives a 99.5-yard loss to those who cavil at it or are critical of the biblical truth. The stones indeed do cry out.
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask about, and you've been there many times, led people and shown people these sites. Is the most significant site in Jerusalem, in fact, Solomon's Temple itself, or at least what's left of that structure?
It's pretty fascinating. You know, if you go to the Wailing Wall today, which is a very familiar part of the Western Wall that Herod the Great built, it's part of the enlarged structure on which the temple sat. Herod extended the platform of the temple far to the south, and the western wall of that enclave is still Herodian masonry, still his own structure. And this is why you have the Jews for centuries coming there and praying and weeping over their national past now that they were under foreign domination. And you can always tell, if you ever go to the Holy Land, you can always tell Herodian masonry, and that is because there's a beautiful 1 or 2 inch margin around the edge of each huge ashlar. And an ashlar is one of these humongous building stones that you can still see today. And again, that's very biblically recall when the disciples tell Jesus, look at these stones, aren't they remarkable? And Jesus, of course, gives something of a put-down when he says, yeah, one's not going to be left upon another. Well, a little exaggeration there, because part of the esplanade, the platform, yeah, they're still hanging together there at the Western Wall. It's about the only place, though. But all of the temple stones themselves, they are a direct fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy just 40 years later when he said, again, they implied that the destruction of the temple would take place and not one stone would be left upon another, and that is absolutely the case today.
Before I let you go, I understand before we had you joined us, you had the pleasure, so to speak, of listening to an interview with the now-famous liberal biblical scholar Bart Ehrman, and naturally found it somewhat frustrating. With about 30 seconds here, what were you reacting to there, Dr. Meyer?
Well, I've never heard any theologian anywhere build the tallest snow-capped mountains out of the flattest molehills. And here he simply contradicts known historical evidence when he said Jesus' body wasn't buried in Joseph's tomb. No, later on, Pilate would put him in a common burial pit with other criminals, and he would not have released the body to Joseph of Arimathea or Nicodemus. This is just rot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't understand the special role that the Jews had under the Roman Empire. They had special exemptions. They didn't have to serve in the army. And many other reasons that, and these are they're Sanhedrin officers. Of course, he would have released them. So he'd be through with this case. He was ticked off anyway that he'd been pressured into crucifying Jesus when they wanted to change the titulus on the cross. He said, "What I've written, I've written. That's it." You know, and he's probably pleased that somebody will take his body off his hands. So I mean, it just for Bart Ehrman to come out like this and echo the old critical, disgusting anti-biblical approaches is very disappointing.
Dr. Paul Meyer is Professor Emeritus of Ancient History at Western Michigan University and author of several books, including his latest, The Constantine Codex. You can purchase The Constantine Codex at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Meyer, thanks for your time.
Fun to be with you again, Todd.
And by the way, we will be interviewing Bart Ehrman for, I believe, the third time later this month. Folks, we have some great shows lined up during Holy Week, and we need you to help us promote our Holy Week programming. It's a bulletin insert to be included this weekend in your church's bulletin. You can find it on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, click support. issuesetc.org, click support. It has some of the programming that we'll be airing for you, brand new programs for you from Issues, etc., during this coming Holy Week, but we need your help in promoting it. So download, print off, and ask your church secretary to include the Issues, Etc. Holy Week programming bulletin insert in your church's bulletin this weekend. Again, you can get it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Danny Faulkner, reviewing Episode 5 of Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hi, this is Pastor Clayton from Zion Lutheran Church of Muscoota, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. I would like to invite you to a special event being hosted by Zion Muscoota. On Saturday, May 3rd, we're hosting a hymnody workshop featuring Pastor William Whedon and Issues Etc. favorite. We'll use the historic hymnody of the church to meditate on the life of Christ. The workshop begins at 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 3rd, and all are welcome. For more information, visit our website at www.zionmuscoota.com.